So I'm going to talk about the truth of our interbeing. That's how we really are. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, we inter are. And how that when we connect with nature like this and we realize we're part of the earth, we came from the earth, we'll go back to the earth, we have great loving kindness to want to care for the earth. And then I want to talk about the joy and the gratitude we get from being connected to earth. And we've talked a little bit about, you know, what will we take with us off retreat? And as wonderful as it is when the mind is concentrated, we feel so happy because the more concentrated the mind is, the more we are free of the afflictions of mind. So we love it. And remember, the concentration is when the mindfulness is more sustained. It actually isn't just so momentary, but it has staying power. We love it. And we can't take it with us, though, unless we're practicing. You know, the one rule of thumb is you have to practice about 3 hours a day for that level of concentration to stay with you. So that's, for most of us, hard. So you can't take that, and you can't take the relief and kind of the bliss that comes with that. But you can take a lot of other things. So you can take the mindfulness. Just knowing what's happening right now, that's always available up until your last breath. And you can take this longing inside, the way this heart beats for well-being, and it also beats for the well-being of the world around you. That's always with you, and it'll always steer you back. We'll get it wrong many, many times, and then we'll remember, oh, you know, what I really want is my own well-being and the well-being of all the beings I love, and the earth. So we can take that with us. And then we can take with us the moments of practice. And so the Tibetan teacher Tulku Urgyen talks about, you know, when you come into a room and turn on the lights, it doesn't matter how long the room has been dark. The light is the same. So if we, you know, take that back to our flashlight analogy, mindfulness is the light and concentration is how long the light stays on and attention is where we point the light. Doesn't matter how long that flashlight has been off. When you come back to that moment of just being here now, you know it's just so much better. And so in a way, your practice off retreat is exactly the same practice as on retreat, which is waking up to this moment right now. And the key to your entire spiritual path is how do you respond in that moment to which you just awoke? When we're lost in distraction, we have no choice. It's that moment of waking up where you realize that I was lost, that is the key moment of your entire life. Because that's the moment where you get to make a choice. And we have moments after moments. So that is the key to our practice, how we respond in that moment when we realize we were lost. That's where we have power and control, and that's how we change, is in those moments. And we string them together and we make big changes. So a moment is always available. That sustaining of the flashlight, again, it depends on much stronger practice than most of us have in daily life. And then something else we take with us off retreat is just, we can take that if it is available to you, just that simple awareness of space. If we put together what Chaz said and I said in our Q&A about how to be relational, you take the inward attention of knowing your body, and the outward attention is, yes, definitely on people and things, but also on the space. I feel like we're sort of invincible. If we can keep our seat, literally like awareness of our seat or awareness of our feet, and also awareness of space, and then there's the we in the space, which is love. It's like we can be warriors, you know, as Trungpa Rinpoche talked about, being warriors for goodness and clarity and connection and love. And we just have to keep taking our seat. And it doesn't matter how many times, you know, you haven't been in your seat. When the light gets turned on, it's on. Period, full stop. So in daily life, we keep orienting again and again, just back to the moment. And all you can ever do in your practice is notice this moment. So that's why in life, the practice is any different on retreat. On retreat, we notice this moment. In life, all we do is notice this moment. It's the same practice. And then somehow, you take with you the insights. So some, you know, in the Q&A came up about insight. What do we do with that? You don't do anything with it. Insights change the way you perceive the world. So it's in you. It's in you the way you're perceiving the world. And the most freeing insight, the insight that, you know, when we really see it, truly, deeply, we always have it with us, is that we're not separate. Our separateness is a mental activity. It's a fiction of mind, and we create it sometimes implicitly or explicitly with language. I am Peter, you are you, I am me, etc. But mostly it's under the radar, it's implicit. We don't need the words to know that I'm a separate self. So you might not think you're a believer in anything. You might not think you're religious. But we're all deeply believers, if we define being religious, believing in something you haven't experienced. Then we are all highly religious. You are a true believer because you believe in something you've never experienced. You believe you're a separate self. If you try to find the separate self, it can't be the thought, I'm me, because as soon as you have the thought, banana, you're gone. So the me can't exist as a thought. It can't exist as an image. Because if you have an image of yourself and then you have an image of anything else, you're gone. So thoughts and images, you know, can't give us the self. Sensations come and go. Our sense experiences come and go. The thought that we're a self, it's our most fundamental belief. And yet we've never seen it. We are highly superstitious. Let's just take a little look at this wackadoodle thought, I'm a self. So if you would, just consider that meal. Maybe we weren't quite as mindful if we were eating and talking, but you know, the French onion soup, that garlic cheese toast or whatever that was, smashed potatoes, woo. They're really smashed right now, aren't they, in your belly. So is the food in your belly right now you? I mean, you could barf it up. You know, I mean, I'm old school, so we always used to say blow chunks, you know. Toss your cookies. So you could do that. So is it you, if it's sitting there in your belly? And you could think about what's in your colon right now. Is it you? I mean, tomorrow it won't be because you'll leave it in the toilet. Your parting gift to Vallecitos. So, you know, we did that reflection on everything we eat being the universe, because the plants aren't separate. We think we're separate, but we eat that food, and it's in our belly. If you can throw it up, I bet most of it would say, it's not really me, or poop it out, or pee it out. So it's not so much you are what you eat, it's just you are what you don't excrete. That's the math. Or blow chunks. So if you think of some little molecule of nutrition in the food, as long as you can throw it up, it isn't you. But if it crosses, you know, the GI tract into the blood, now it's got to be me, right? It's the same molecule, but it's inside my belly now. But when it gets outside the GI tract and into the blood, then it's me. Do you see how wackadoodle it is? It's just only the universe that you've swallowed, but we say it's me as long as it's outside the GI tract, but not me if it's in it, even though I carry it around in my body. So it's like I'm carrying a little septic tank. And now how about just take a breath in. And we get all the oxygen in the air is put here by plants. And in fact, it was put here 2 billion years ago when bacteria invented photosynthesis. So there was no oxygen in the air in the Earth's atmosphere until bacteria put it there. So we breathe this in. Is all that air in your lungs you? Now you breathe it out. It was me, but then I breathe it out. Now it's not me. It's ludicrous. You know, and then we know the brain requires something like 25% of the body's oxygen use. So all that oxygen from the atmosphere put here by bacteria and replenished by plants, it's only the universe and the whole history of the universe in every breath. And it's powering your brain right now to listen and think. But we say it's me, as if we're separate. So it's wackadoodle. So sensory clarity, which I talked about the first night, the difference between our five physical senses and the sixth sense of the mind, which is mostly just a recreation of the other five. All our loyalty is to the fantasy. None of it to the raw data. And we hope this retreat has helped you. You know, again, if you just double the percentage in your experience, you're still 98% loyal to the fantasy. But the sensory clarity aligns us with the logical truth that there logically can't be a self. Because the five physical senses don't give us the self. The more we rest in our sensory experience, I mean, we just love it. I mean, how awesome is it to look at the way the grass waves, you know, in the breeze? The way there's just little, you know, bundles of yellow here and there in the aspen trees, you know. Or listening to the river, like some of you said, hearing all the different sounds. So it doesn't just feel good because it's when we're more in this being mode, but it also gives us the insight that we belong. And it's what we want. We won't rest until we know we belong. But we already belong. It's just our minds tricking us into separateness, but only 10, 15, 20,000 times a day. So our retreat is called Meditation, Nature, and Awakening. And awakening is, a huge part of it is sensory clarity, seeing clearly your sensory experience, and all your experience is sensory. And sensory clarity penetrates the illusion of separateness. And we are awakening to this profoundly transforming insight that we belong. We pre-belong. We came pre-approved and we pre-belong, but then we forgot and we forget all the time. But Rilke remembered. And Rilke wrote this, not to be cut off, not through the slightest partition shut out from the law of the stars. The inner, what is it, if not intensified sky, hurled through with birds and deep with the winds of homecoming? Dang. And here's Li Po, 8th century Chinese poet. The birds have vanished into the sky, and now the last cloud drains away. We sit together, the mountain and me, until only the mountain remains. So to not be separate means we enter our. We enter our with each other. We enter our with the sky and the food that we eat and don't excrete. We enter our, and we're conditioned by everything else. We're influenced by everything else. You think you're a separate self who's always some way, but you're just, there might be sort of reliable tendencies in your mind-body system. You know, you're an introvert, you're an extrovert. But all you're doing is coming and going all day long due to conditions. And how can you find the thing that is stable and the same? You know, we act like we were just never born. We act like we've just been here all along as a separate self. And my mom died a year and a half ago, and it was a very intense experience. My two brothers and I shepherding her through her last week. And she died a really good death, like really good death. She had her three boys with her. The best thing about my mom, as she would just say this all the time, the best thing I ever did was have you boys. So we were with her, the three of us and my wife, Lisa, in her last week. She barely knew we were there, but she got it. And we were the ones that really clued her in. She didn't know what was happening, and she had a cogent time where we had to explain to her there's no more doctors we could call. Nothing could be done. And she just said, so this is it. We said, this is it. And You know, and then she just sort of went back into wherever she was. We have no idea. I had this enduring image of a deer fawn in this luminous forest glade, just waiting when I would meditate next to my mom. I kept having this fawn. And then when my mom died, the fawn was gone. So that's the image for me of where mom is, where, you know, who knows, but in going through all her photos, she was a hoarder. So that cartoon, you know, about the someday, son, this will all be yours. Mom had 6 storage units in Tulsa, 2 in Oklahoma City. She was a state legislator in the Oklahoma State Senate. So she had an Oklahoma City office. And we still have a storage unit with her stuff in it. So mom passed, but her stuff didn't. But one of the pictures that I love so much. So my mom and dad divorced when I was 15. And she was 19 when she married. I mean, a lot of us are old enough to have parents that young. She was 19, my dad was 23. And there's a picture of them. It's looking at them, looking out the back window of a car on their way to their honeymoon. They've just left the wedding. We have all their wedding pictures, but the last picture is just of them looking out the back window of their car, and it's kind of a small window, like a porthole window in this back of this car. And you can see my dad's full face, and he's smiling. And you can. My mom was, if anyone knows the Enneagram, a 7 on the Enneagram, a total enthusiast, just a lover of life. You don't mean it. Is that not the most beautiful sunset you've ever seen in your entire life? So, but the picture, I love it because you can't see her smiling, but you see her eyes and you can tell she's just beaming, but her smile is below the window. So you just see her eyes and you see my dad's beaming face, and they're off to their honeymoon. So they didn't make me that night, but they might have made my older brother Joe. But my point is, and I did digress. I'm just here because of that gleam and that smile, you know? And my dad's face. That's why I'm here. That's the condition. I mean, and I think I'm some separate self. It's ludicrous. It's ludicrous. Thank God your parents, you know, had the hots for each other. Because that's your condition. I want to read this in the spirit of great love. It's talking about emptiness. And when, you know, this word, I just don't like the word at all. It's one of these words, you know, that communicates the exact opposite of what it means. Because it really means great love, total belonging. It means the absence of you. And the absence of you is, you know, we say emptiness. But the best feeling I've ever had in the world, finally, was the absence of Peter. Because then I'm just everything. So when we finally freaking drop this burden, we're so damn happy because we belong. And so this is what Matthieu Ricard says about our interdependence. A Western monk in the Tibetan tradition A rainbow is formed by the play of a shaft of sunlight falling on a cloud of raindrops. It appears, but it's intangible. As soon as one of the factors contributing to it is missing, the phenomenon disappears. So the rainbow has no apparent nature of its own, and you can't speak of the dissolution or annihilation of something that didn't exist in the first place. That something only owed its illusory appearance to a transitory coming together of elements which aren't intrinsically existing entities themselves either. Therefore, all phenomena are the result of a combination of transitory factors. I mean, it sounds a little academic, but then he says this. This is the way enlightened beings relate to everything. The world is made of rainbows. Everything briefly appears, then gradually or suddenly disappears. Imagine how your relationship to the world would change if you realize it is all made of rainbows. You are sitting on a rainbow. You are holding a rainbow in your hands. You go to sleep on a rainbow bed and cover yourself with a rainbow blanket. You eat and drink rainbows. You put rainbow clothes on a rainbow body, and you make love to a rainbow mate. When your rainbow house disappears, it is no big deal. That's just what rainbows do. So my mom was an amazing rainbow of passion, and she could be exasperating, difficult, and wonderful, and she was a rainbow. And you're a rainbow, I'm a rainbow, our retreat is a rainbow, this moment is a rainbow. From one of my poems, I just have this little couplet that I like. The past is a ghost, the future a dream, and the present moment trembles on cold legs. Our life is very bizarre. But all of this is in the spirit of great love. We're conditioned and we're impermanent and we're just the result of everything else, and it just flows, flows, flows. And Chaz and JD and I emailed about this retreat, you know, over the months, you know, as this thing, like it was a book on a shelf. And, you know, then it comes and it's like, okay, we meet 33 yogis and we're trying to learn your names. And I think I finally learned everyone's name. Now you're all leaving, so it's not fair, but it's just been nothing but flow. This is a rainbow retreat. Your moods that have come and gone are rainbow moods. And, you know, the more we do this practice, the more we realize the incredible wisdom in this tradition. All we have is this moment. Even if it's trembling on cold legs, it's what we've got. And then this leads to great love. We are so appreciative and loving of everything because we're a miracle, and you're a miracle, and a chickadee is a miracle, and an aspen leaf turning yellow is a miracle. A rock in the road is a miracle. And all of this comes through the ability to finally just relax into your senses and just enjoy yourself. And so we come to great love through this because we're a lover of life because, you know, like Jennifer Wellwood said, like all that difficult stuff, you know, when you finally welcome it, transforms you, and then the difficult stuff itself is transformed into this radiant presence and love. And so our practice, this retreat, has been one of opening to nature, opening our senses, and all doing this together. All of you have had such difficulty and such, you know, ease, at least moments of ease, if not times of ease. You know, we've all been doing these huge ups and downs on our boat together. And we're all in this together. And we can't open to nature now without acknowledging the harm we're causing. Like Chaz was saying last night, it's like we're sick animals. We're fouling the only nest we have. And if you followed any of the 50th landing on the moon, and the most famous picture, the first picture, you know, of Earth from outer space beamed back, you know, Earthrise, there were, you know, probably earlier pictures, but the famous one is the Earth rising over the surface of the moon when maybe it was Apollo 9 that, you know, they orbited the moon without landing on it. But they took that picture as they were orbiting the moon. It's just god-awful beautiful, like this planet just spinning in space. And it's the only planet we have. And we have, you know, what we're doing is, it's just mind-blowing that we're going to actually threaten the entire planet. The planet will always be here, but the planet as we know it. And so, you know, in integrating off retreat, we might ask, well, what is the point of all this? And a very simple answer from a Zen teacher who was asked, what's the point of practice, said, an appropriate response. So half the circle is becoming clear about how we suffer and how we can make ourselves happy. If we can't be clear about that, we're not going to be of much use to the world. But the other half of the circle is meeting the challenges of the world and taking action from love and clarity. And so this is what we take off retreat, the ability to respond appropriately. And the ironic, the paradoxical theory of change says that change begins with acceptance. It's totally a paradox. Because if you can't accept what is, then you can't see clearly what is. And if you can't see clearly what is, you don't know what to do. So all this work of accepting things as they are, your breath as it is, the sadness as it is, this delight as it is, this not only is healing for us in knowing what we need, but it's going to help us much better take action in the world. And so when we think about what we're doing to the planet, some of you have just expressed it's hard to be here and not think about it. So at our Eco Dharma Center, where, you know, we're really doing these retreats where we face this. And the most important thing is connection. When we connect with nature, then we realize what we're doing. And for most people, common responses are grief or fear. And grief is really good because it means we're connecting with what's happening and we're opening to it. And we didn't do it on this retreat. It's just, this wasn't an eco-dharma retreat, but we can do this. It's really healing. The first thing is acceptance, which is just knowing what's happening. And it's shocking, shocking to accept what's happening. But you can go into nature and you can talk to nature. You can go to a tree or a spot or a place and you can apologize and you can ask for help and you can just confess your feelings and you can ask for help with your feelings. And nature's incredibly hospitable for your feelings. And then a second step, we want to jump to solutions, but remember, solutions come first from acceptance. So there's a necessary grieving we have to do, because that's coming from the clear seeing of what's happening. We want to jump to a solution so quickly that we avoid the grief. The grief is the first step. And then we have really more a truer sense of what can be done or what we can do. And you can ask nature for help. What can I do? Just talk to the trees. Confess your feelings. Apologize. Ask what you can do. And when we take action, understanding the truth of interdependence, the one thing that doesn't work is to try to win and try to defeat who you're opposing. Because we're all on the same planet, hurtling through space, miraculously, this incredible blue and green and white swirl of a jewel. It's the only home we have. And so with the wisdom of practice, we see it's all relationship. If we want to make change, we have to tend to relationships. If we, in a democracy, if we want to affect people, we have to affect relationships. And so instead of trying to win, we can try to understand and connect. And a super important principle in taking action is to separate people from their actions. We can oppose harmful actions while remembering the humanity of people behind the actions. We're all the same. In the deepest, the stuff that matters, we all have in common. We all want to love and be loved. Nobody really enjoys being mortal. You know, we're vulnerable to hurt and rejection. Every human being shares this, maybe every sentient being. So we do know this, but we don't know much else about people. We don't know their values, their motives, their intentions. We don't know. Are they crazy? You know, are they stupid? We might think so. We don't totally know. But what we can know is that we see harm is happening in their actions that we oppose, and we oppose the actions without opposing the people. And so the Dalai Lama, in talking about the Chinese and the oppression of his own people, with something like 20% of the population dying at the hands of the Chinese, he says this in a book, The Wisdom of Forgiveness, with a Chinese author and their good friends. So he says this: I always tell people it's very important. And the book is quoting him in his kind of broken English. It's cute. I always tell people it's very important to make distinction, actor and act. We have to oppose bad action, but that does not mean we are against that person, that actor. Once the action has stopped, a different action can come, and then that person could be a friend. That's why today the Chinese are the enemy. The next day they can always become the friend. That's why I have no problem forgiving the Chinese for what they've done to my people. So, we can take action. We can even take urgent, fierce action that's not based on hatred or anger, but based on care and compassion, and we recognize urgency is needed. And a lot is changing in the Dharma world around this, around bringing our practice into action and intersecting issues with the ecological crisis, with issues of social justice and inclusivity, and we have to do them all at once. because climate change, you know, affects people of color and lower income people much more than well-to-do people and white people statistically. So we can't look at eco-crisis and not look at social justice. And we can do it. And our practice is our ticket. We can take action while staying grounded and centered and acting from love. Okay. Believe it or not, I'm going to completely change the channel. Because pain is just one part of life, and the other part of life is joy. And I know you all have experienced so much joy here. And I think the Dalai Lama is an incredible role model for how to be open-hearted. And the awake heart meets pain with compassion. The awake heart meets joy with gratitude or sympathetic joy. Someone else's joy just makes me joyful. Or my own joy just makes me grateful. And you know, part of being joyful is just lightening up. We can enlighten up. Enlightenment is not just about, oh, the first noble truth, life sucks, you know. And let's just take things a little lightly. Like, look at the Buddhist tradition. So in our tradition, this is how it goes. And again, I'm just going to be, what's the word? Provocative. Yeah, you know, you keep coming back because of attachment. The reason we're reborn is we're attached. And if we're attached, life sucks. So we keep coming back because life sucks. But if we get enlightened and we're finally completely happy and life finally doesn't suck, guess what? We never come back. What kind of religion are we in here? Come, oh my God, this sucks. So we can poke fun of ourselves. Our tradition, you know. I mean, here's a typical Zen situation. A student is on one side of a raging river. There's no bridges. He has no boat. He shouts out to the Zen master on the opposite bank, "How do I get to the other side?" The master shouts back, "You are on the other side." So the Zen tradition, are known, you know, when we have these kind of inner tradition dialogues, you know, the Zenis say to the Vipassana people, "Oh, God, you Vipassana people, you explain everything," and we say to the Zenis, "Well, you don't explain anything, you know, and you're so lucky." The Vipassana, you know, as teachers, we're the very talkative tradition. We give long Dharma talks, if you haven't noticed. Shinzen Young, a Vipassana teacher, said, "Yeah, I talk too much to be a Zen teacher." One of my friends who's a Dharma teacher, I'm not kidding you. I taught his group in Boulder. He's an amazing teacher, great teacher. And I taught a class called The Entire Buddhist Path in One Sentence. But because I'm a Theravada Vipassana teacher, it took me an hour to deliver the sentence. But I busted on him because the class he had taught earlier was called The Dharma in a Nutshell, Part 2. I'm like, you have a Vipassana teacher, because only a Vipassana teacher can say that. So he did a two-hour teaching on the Dharma in a nutshell. I don't know how to characterize Tibetan teachers, but, you know, we do have the Dalai Lama as the, you know, worldwide amazing example of the Tibetan tradition and wisdom and compassion. And You know, so there's the joke. It's sort of okay. You know, what did the Dalai Lama say when he went into the pizza shop? Make me one with everything. And then he got his pizza, and the Dalai Lama said, can I have my change? And the pizza vendor said, well, Your Holiness, change has to come from within. So, but what's really funny is you can YouTube this about not tomorrow at 10 a.m., but let's say a few days from now when you're on the internet. The Dalai Lama was somewhere in Australia, and he was being interviewed on a TV show, and it was like the roving reporter on the street interviewing the Dalai Lama. And the anchors, you know, were back in the TV studio, and so they sent to their colleague, and so the colleague decides he's going to try to alert the Dalai Lama to the fact of this joke about the pizza shop. So he tries to tell the Dalai Lama this joke. So he says, you know, Your Holiness, there's this joke that's, you know, kind of a meme on the internet. And okay, what's the joke? So the Dalai Lama walks into a pizza shop. The Dalai Lama says, pizza shop, what's a pizza shop? And the guy is like, oh boy, how am I? And the editor starts cutting back and forth between the anchors and the reporter, and the anchors are just starting to laugh hilariously, like, he is so in trouble, like, how's he going? Well, Your Holiness, you know, a pizza shop, it's where they sell pizza, and, you know, it's very popular. Oh yes, pizza shop. So the Dalai Lama walks into a pizza shop. What did the Dalai Lama say? Oh, I don't know. What, you know, make me one with everything. Oh. And the Dalai Lama just doesn't laugh. He's still like, just doesn't even get that it's a joke. And the guy is just, he just can't dig himself out. But the funniest thing is just the anchors are just like practically out of their seats laughing at like how badly this guy has blown his interview with the Dalai Lama. So. All right, so our tradition's funny, and being on retreat is funny. I don't know if you've noticed that was this one, but there's a phenomenon on your retreat. You know, you can't read, you can't write. We might have botched that instruction a little bit because y'all were awesome with the retreat container, but there was some fair bit of reading and writing going on. But, you know, on retreat, you can't read anything. So then you're in the bathroom, you know, and got the roll of toilet paper, but you look on the shelf and there's the pack of four, and it's like Fort Howard toilet paper. Wow, this is from Wisconsin. Oh man, you know, look at the 1-800 number, you know, and you're just like reading the toilet paper like, this is amazing. They make, God, this paper's all the way from Wisconsin. So my wife, as a Bodhisattva act, she gave me a great t-shirt, which I used to wear on retreat, something that yogis could read. Ask me about my vow of silence. And I had another favorite t-shirt for retreat, instant person, just add coffee. And, you know, there's shirt t-shirts you could wear on retreat to give people reading material. Lisa has a great t-shirt. It's a picture of this cutest little kitty, and then under it, it says, don't stress me out. That would be a nice one to wear on retreat. But, you know, ask me about my vow of silence is kind of taunting. Beer is proof God loves us and wants us to be happy. Ben Franklin. That would be sort of a taunting t-shirt to wear on retreat. Maybe this would be taunting, too. The five stages of waking up at 6 a.m., denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. And then walking meditation, so slow, lifting, moving, placing, you know, or for me it's often lifting, moving, spacing, and you know, I'm wondering life's eternal questions. I stayed up all night the other night researching the internet. I must have searched hundreds of sites trying to find the answer. Was I an internet addict? And Or I might wonder, why can't you tickle yourself? Or I might wonder, if you want to double your homeopathic dose, do you cut it in half? What sadist would put an S in the word lisp? What sadist would name a memory drug phosphatidylserine? I take that. Any of you take phosphatidylserine? I mean, come on, that is sadistic. So we go on retreat. It's very odd. But we get, it's amazing, it's powerful. There's so many funny retreat stories we could all tell, but in the interest of time, I'll stop with that. This practice is the practice of joy. I know we've all experienced the joy of being here and connecting to so much beauty. And are we grateful? Are we grateful for the weather we've been given? And wasn't the rain awesome to help us? I mean, if we want to be really selfish about it, to help us appreciate, you know, all the other good weather. It's obviously so good for the earth. But the beauty of this land, the beauty of wherever you live, you know, the beauty of the sky, wherever you live, you've always got the sky and the clouds. I mean, if you're in Manhattan or downtown LA, you've still got nature. You've got, like Chaz says, the little trees around you or the little squirrels. So we're so damn lucky in so many ways. And life is so hard in so many ways also. But it's also so wonderful in so many ways. And with our negativity bias of our brain, it's not good enough to go to the park and only focus on the dog shit. If you don't see the trees and the flowers and the tulips and the kids playing, you have to do that to be reality-based. Negativity bias of the brain is just, you know, really problematic. So a very, very important takeaway practice is just saying thank you. You know, you can take that away from retreat. It's not just politeness. It's a deep, deep connection with what's joyful, and to stop and look and pay attention and soak it in and say thank you. That's deep spiritual practice. So we can take our thank yous out of this retreat and into our lives, busy, turbulent, difficult lives, and full of joy too. So we have the pain and we have the joy. And we have the ability, though, to remember 60 times a minute, a lot's going right. Your heart is beating away. You have this gift of life. And what else is there to do but be and love? And out of love, do. What else, you know? So I will leave you with the most famous poem. Well, might be true, I read it on the internet. In Japanese literature, it's a gratitude poem from Ryokan. It's very short. And he was, J.D. alluded to him, and he was abbot of a monastery in Japan in kind of early 1800s, late 1700s, early 1800s. But he didn't like all the burdens of being in charge of a monastery, so became kind of like a beggar, wise fool who just spent a lot of time playing with children, begged for food, lived in a little hut, hardly had any belongings. And one day, he came back to his little hut and found that he had been robbed of everything. And this was his response. The thief left it behind, the moon in the window. Let's sit.